Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we report on the destruction of the Novohakhovo Dam on the Dnipro River in Kherson. We look at the impacts on the land, the people, and of course, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station. I also speak to Volodymyr Kadyrov, founder of the Seeds for Ukraine initiative, who's helping families and farmers in the liberated territories rebuild their lives.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
This hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin must end in failure.
We need a military strategy for Ukraine to gain a decisive advantage on the battlefield, to win the war.
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Tuesday, the 6th of June, 1 year and 102 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our assistant comment editor Francis Dernley, senior foreign correspondent Roland Oliphant, Ukrainian journalist Tatiana Bezruk, and our foreign reporter, Maidna Nanu. I started by asking Francis for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, thank you, David. As you say, a huge story broke overnight, and we've just been absorbing its impact and implications this morning. The Novohakhovka Dam in southern Ukraine has been destroyed in what some are calling the largest man-made disaster in Europe since Chernobyl in 1986. We understand that this vast Soviet-era dam in the Russian-controlled part of the country was blown up at around 2:50 a.m. in the morning local time, unleashing a flood of water across the war zone. Something, I should say, that's been reported by both Ukrainian and Russian forces this morning, putting more than 80 settlements and 16,000 people in immediate danger. President Zelensky has called security advisers together for an emergency meeting, and we understand that evacuations are already underway. Earlier videos on social media showed a series of intense explosions around the dam, and other clips show water surging through its remains, with bystanders expressing their shock. And more recent ones that I've just been looking at show these affected settlements flooded, the countryside half submerged, and already, of course, thousands of animals have been drowned. We haven't heard of any human casualties yet, but of course, this is a breaking story, and it's just too early to say what the impact of this has been. This dam is truly enormous. It is 3.2 kilometers long and holds 18 cubic kilometers of water. That's equal to that in the Great Salt Lake in the US state of Utah. People are saying it will take 4 days for it to empty completely. And authorities in Kherson, some 80 kilometres downstream, are predicting that the water levels will reach critical point in the next 5 hours or so. So I recommend that listeners follow our live blog, because we'll be reporting on that as news comes in. Both sides are blaming the other for the destruction of the dam, but the vast majority of reliable sources believe that Russia is responsible. The EU has already accused Russia of barbaric aggression as a consequence of the attack. Zelensky warned back in October that the Russians had mined the dam and had called for international observers. And we discussed the danger of such an attack several months ago. But this morning, many are arguing that clearly there has been a failure of the international community here to make it clear that they were observing the dam and what the consequences would be if it was destroyed. And they're saying that because those red lines were not drawn, that it made it capable, made it possible for Russia to do this. Indeed, Ukraine's military intelligence are saying Russian forces blew up the dam in a panic, calling it an obvious act of terrorism and a war crime, which will be evidence in an international tribunal. Now, the timing of this is, of course, significant. Analysts this morning are saying that further to the potential impacts on agriculture and the environment, which will be catastrophic, the flooding could prevent further Ukrainian advances in the south and threaten the safety of Europe's largest nuclear power plant at Zaporizhia, which I'll come to in a moment. This flooding will theoretically delay the Ukrainian army from fording the river and crossing to the left bank, which many theorised was potentially part of the Ukrainian strategy for the counteroffensive. Now, we also understand that the Kakhovka hydroelectric power plant in Russian-occupied territory has been deployed completely as well and cannot be restored after a detonation inside the engine room. That's according to Ukraine's state hydroelectric company. Again, this is leading some to speculate this morning that Russia is seeking to destroy utilities in danger of being targeted or attacked during any counteroffensive. Now, I said I'd talk about the nuclear power plant. So Ukraine's state atomic power agency has said the destruction of the dam does pose a threat, but that the situation in the facility is currently under control. I'll read a quote from them. Water from the reservoir is necessary for the station to receive power for turbine capacitors and safety systems of the plant. Right now, the station's cooling pond is full. As of 8 a.m, the water level is 16.6 meters, which is sufficient for the station's needs. Now, the UN Atomic Energy Agency has also said that its experts are closely monitoring the situation and that there is no immediate nuclear safety risk at the facility. But according to the Ukraine War Environmental Consequences Working Group, a total collapse in the dam would wash away much of the left bank and cause a severe drop in the reservoir, which could potentially have a major impact on crucial cooling at the plant. But as I say, that doesn't seem to be an immediate danger this morning. Nonetheless, another of the consequences of this attack is that it will lead to reassessments of just how far Russia will be willing to go in this war. And we theorised some time ago whether they would be willing to trigger a nuclear incident in Zaporizhia if they felt it gave them a strategic advantage. Many are now saying this morning that this is strategically feasible. And just lastly, the other major impact of this being discussed this morning is on Crimea, although of course there are different views on this. The Russian-backed governor has said that there is a risk that water levels in the North Crimea Canal, which carries fresh water to the peninsula from the Dnipro River, could fall after a blast at the dam. The canal was blocked by Ukraine after Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, and that led to acute water shortages on the peninsula that only ended after Russian forces seized the canal in March last year. Others, however, are saying that in reality, Russia is already capable of supplying Crimea with water and supplies if required. So that's where we are, David, as of 1 p.m. London time. But this is a very fast moving story, so inevitably there will be a lot of developments over the next few hours.
Thank you very much, Francis. I believe we do have Tetyana Bezruk on the line joining us from Ukraine. Could you talk us through a little bit what the reaction in Ukraine has been like? And I understand you're from the region itself. Could you talk about the region affected?
Well, I woke up today's morning because a friend of mine called me and told that the Kakhovka Dam is damaged. Then I was trying to get some news and was trying to call to my relatives who are on the occupied land bank of Kherson region. And then what I saw was, like, actually, I can't still believe that it's true, because I was born and raised not far from that place, and I crossed this dam like 1,000 times when I was a child and a student. You know, this like Kherson region is a region with a lot of fields, farmers. The water in this region is pretty important for harvest. I'm trying to get also some news because I'm not on the front line right now. And I saw a lot of initiatives inside Ukraine. People are trying to help to evacuate people and animals from the area.
Thanks, Tatiana. How would you describe the mood in amongst you and your friends from hearing this news? It sounds, certainly in London, it was total shock when we woke up and saw what had happened. What have you seen amongst your colleagues?
Like, everyone also shocked because, like, we saw a lot what Russia did in occupied territories, yeah? But how can one imagine even that they will damage the Kakhovka Dam, because it's there for like for a half of century. It's important not only like for our history, it's important for citizens of Ukraine, like for the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. And everyone was shocked, but if you may saw, for the last 10 years Ukrainians are very organized. And now I am and my colleagues are trying to get to the cities where people will be evacuated. I saw different volunteer organizations who are trying to evacuate people to provide them with humanitarian aid, humanitarian and legal assistance. We are all shocked, but it's our country and we should help people who are now in this situation.
Francis mentioned earlier some of the potential future impacts of this astonishing, awful news. How do you think in the days and weeks to come this will impact Ukraine, but also the war itself?
It's already impacted Ukraine because people lost their homes, not even like because of shelling. Like, I saw those pictures and videos where the wall house was like moving on the river, on the top of the water, and as I also mentioned, people lost their houses physically. They do not have even where to hide. And as the Minister of Interior Affairs of Ukraine wrote that Russia is continuously shelling on the right bank, even after this Kakhovka Dam damage.
Thank you very much, Tatiana. Francis and Roland, do you have any questions for Tatiana? Or Roland, shall we go to your reaction to the news this morning?
Hello, David. Hello, Tatiana. Yes, I mean, it's fascinating to hear from somebody, you know, with such a connection to that part of the world. I've been on the phone to some of my contacts in Kherson today, and it's a mixed picture. And interestingly to me, the general attitude from the people I've spoken to is one of stoicism. So I was speaking to a woman in Kherson this morning who said, you know, look, the people who remain in this city are now used to dealing with difficult situations. We get shelled a lot. Many people have already left. It's a kind of self-selecting population that's still there. And she made the point, actually, that this has been, everybody has been aware of this danger for some time. So if you remember back in October, I think President Zelensky publicly accused the Russians of plotting to do something like this. And at the time, actually, Ukrainian media ran kind of analyses of what it would look like. Maps have been distributed. There were plans in place. People kind of knew which areas of Kherson City, at least, were in danger of flooding. And the message I was getting, at least from the three or four people I've spoken to this morning, was that, you know, people kind of understood where the areas of threat were and started moving out, you know, fairly quickly. And it sounded to me like not much panic. I was speaking to an ambulance driver who was also involved in evacuations from a village just to the east, upstream from Kherson, who said, you know, look, the water is, to give you an idea of how fast the water is rising, they were driving out there early in the morning, so probably around 6. There was already water around in the fields and beginning to cross the roads, but they could drive through. On the way back, after picking up a couple of elderly people who were unable to move themselves, they had to find other roads because the roads they used were already flooded, inundated, impassable. That said, her account of the atmosphere in that village was people kind of watching, taking photos of the water, trying to decide what to do. A lot of them had already done kind of one or two trips out with their own cars, kind of taking people out and coming back in, working out what to do with their stuff. That's not everywhere. There are parts of Kherson city, particularly lower down, closer to the bank, because Kherson itself is built, you know, quite on an elevation. But there are neighbourhoods lower down, closer to the bank, that are being flooded right now. But it is the left bank. Everyone I've spoken to is saying, look, the real problem is on the left bank. And all along the Dnieper, actually, the left bank is basically the lower bank. It is much lower lying. And one woman I was speaking to said she just got off the phone to her uncle who lives on that side under Russian occupation. And he was saying, look, you know, I asked her, look, did he get any warning? You know, if the Russians did this, did they bother to kind of tell people, look, you better evacuate because we're going to do this? He said, no, nothing. He woke up in the morning, tuned into Ukrainian media. That was how he found out what was going on. And he had to walk to safety before the floodwaters reached his home. So it's going to be much, much worse, I think, simply because of the geography on that left-hand side of the bank.
Thanks very much, Roland. Tetiana, is what Roland was reporting there from what he's hearing from Kherson and some of his contacts, does that line up with what you're hearing as well, or are there any differences?
A friend of mine who are like working in a volunteer organization, they are now hiring to Kherson for people's evacuation. Yeah, and not only for people, but also for their animals. The situation is pretty clear, described by Roland, yeah.
Thank you very much, Tetiana. Roland, can I come back to you? Can I pose you the same question that I did to Tetiana, in fact? I mean, this is obviously very, very early on. It's a huge breaking story from early this morning. But if we were to look ahead over the days and weeks to come, months even, how do you think this will impact the war itself?
Well, look, let's start with the immediate impact. And we have varying estimates, quite wildly varying estimates, of how far the water is going to rise and when it will peak. So one of the residents of Kherson I was speaking to earlier today said that her understanding, what she'd been told or heard from the authorities or public announcements, was the water is going to rise for 3 days. Other people are saying it's going to reach critical period, the worst point within 10 hours. There are old Soviet estimates, because the Soviets game planned this. You know, what happens if the dam failed? They built it. And they said, you know, you're going to see the water rising, or the flood is not going to recede, I think was their estimate, for a week. So at least for, you know, the next 10 hours critical, the next week is going to be pretty bad. And then perhaps, you know, the waves, the kind of 3-meter-high waves, will begin to subside. So that's the immediate impact. On the war, look, I think, you know, no one's claiming responsibility, as it were, but I think on balance, it's pretty clear whose interests it was in to do this. And I think it's clearly a defensive measure, a desperate defensive measure, but in a way a sensible defensive measure by the Russians. So as all our listeners know, the Dnipro has basically been the front line. So from south of Zaporizhia all the way down to the mouth of Dnipro, basically it was a watery front line. No man's land was the river. The Ukrainians controlled the right bank, the Russians the left bank. Now there's been shelling back and forth. Now above the dam, in this enormous reservoir that Francis was describing, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 miles across in places, the idea of, you know, putting an amphibious landing across there was pretty far-fetched, to say the least. Below the dam, you had stretches of river that were only about, I say only because it's still a pretty formidable obstacle, but we're talking 300, 400 meters. There had been a lot of Ukrainian activity with riverine boats. We know they put special forces across the river. They'd made little bridgeheads in the marshlands, that low-lying marshland we were just talking about on the left bank. And over the past month or so, there have been quite intense battles way down, much further downriver from the dam. In the delta, there's a bunch of low-lying islands. And the Ukrainians and the Russians have been fighting for control of those islands quite intensively for, well, I wouldn't want to put a date on it, but like, I was there. I was in the area roughly a month ago now, and those fights were audible and, you know, clearly quite intense. And it definitely looks as if, however unlikely it might seem, the Ukrainians at least wanted to make it plausible, make it appear like they were able to, or perhaps preparing, to put an amphibious landing across the river as part of the counteroffensive. Now, whether or not they were actually going to risk that, because it was obviously going to be risky, I think the Russians have pretty much decided, you know, or not to risk it, basically. So the point of blowing the dam is suddenly a river that was 300 meters across is now, I don't know how big the flooding is going to be, but we're going to be talking about kilometers of waterway that would have to be crossed, landing areas that the Ukrainians would have done reconnaissance on will be flooded. The bank will have changed. The river flow would have changed. So if the Ukrainians had those plans, the Russians will be hoping that will have massively disrupted that. And I suppose that means in turn that you know, the river Dnipro, the idea of resuming war of movement across the river is even more far-fetched. So we can expect the war of movement to perhaps be concentrated, you know, on the left bank in Zaporizhia and Donetsk and Kharkiv and Luhansk regions. And there's a couple of other things to think about. On the Crimean Canal, I'm personally a bit skeptical about, you know, the immediate humanitarian impact of that, because Crimea survived relatively well that while that canal was blocked by the Ukrainians for about 8 years on drinking water. What it will do is have a big impact on agricultural water used across southern occupied Ukraine. So a very large knock-on effect for farming, basically, which is not a direct impact on the war and the conduct of combat operations, but it's a big problem for whoever's going to end up controlling that territory going forward. And then, you have the nuclear power station. I think, as Francis was saying, you know, it doesn't look like that is critically endangered at this moment, but it certainly complicates many things.
Thank you very much, Roland. Tatiana or Francis, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I'm happy to come up with some historical parallels later on, and I'll talk about those. But I just think if we're talking about the impact of this, I want to underline the point I said earlier on, which I think there will be many people who have adjusted to a kind of idea of what this war looks like. They imagine it as fairly frozen, fairly static, and they're anticipating some kind of counteroffensive. This has ruptured that, and evidently that will have an impact on the political response within Europe, within the West, and also many people who just aren't following the war as closely as we are, who will think, my goodness, what on earth is going on here? And it will draw their attention to what Russia has done in Ukraine and is doing there, and also will make them follow the war again. So there are going to be a lot of consequences of this that are hard to register. But as I say, I think it's going to be very interesting seeing how this leads to recalculations of how far Russia is able to go to retain the territory it currently has. As I said earlier, there are those who questioned whether they even saw it as completely irrational that Russia would try and stage any kind of environmental disaster, nuclear disaster, that could in some way freeze the war, that could somehow advantage them on the front line. And yet this is clearly an example of an incident that has huge consequences on Ukraine more broadly and on those places that they currently occupy. And yet they have been willing to do them, either to disrupt the narrative of the counteroffensive, which they feel is harmful for their prospects in the war, or for the strategic advantages that we were just describing there. Either way, it's a big step. Some would describe it as an escalation. And so this will lead to, as I say, David, I think quite considerable reassessments over the coming days as to quite how far Russia is willing to go. And I can easily imagine that some will say that this could have negative consequences for Ukraine, because they will say, well, actually, we need to take the nuclear threat more seriously from Russia. I'm not saying I think that, but I'm saying that I think there will be some who will be calling for that as a consequence of this. Now, the other side of the coin, of course, is that it gives yet another injection of the moral rightness, superiority that Ukraine has in this war. They were invaded. This would not have happened were it not for the fact that they were attacked by Russia. And it is yet another example of a war crime being perpetrated by the Russian state on Ukrainian people. Now, yes, and as I say, I will come to historical parallels later, this often dams are considered legitimate targets in war. But there are rules as to how you're meant to identify said targets, and those have not been followed. Roland was describing there how nobody was aware that this was going to be taking place on the ground. And so there is a very high likelihood that some people have died as a consequence of this. And that's before you even go into the environmental impacts. So there'll be many people waking up to this war crime this morning, and they'll be saying, what on earth has happened? And their outrage at what is being done and perpetrated on the Ukrainian people will no doubt give an impetus to Ukraine from Western supporters, but also I'm sure amongst the Ukrainians themselves, who will say this is yet another example of why Russia cannot be allowed to win this war.
Thank you very much, Francis. Tatiana, I saw you unmuted as well when I asked for any further reaction. Would you like to come in?
The only thing I want to say that it's really clear who did it, who destroyed Kakhovka Dam. Russia did it and Russian soldiers. And there is no reason for Ukrainian army to destroy the dam, because even if you are not a soldier or not military affiliated, it's obvious that this was it's impossible strategically. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Tatiana. It was really interesting to hear your reporting, and thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a big day. So thank you so much, and best of luck with your reporting in the future. Maidna, you've been on the Ukraine Live blog. For all of our listeners, the Ukraine Live blog on the war, we run every single day from the foreign desk. Maidna, you've been obviously following this breaking story all day. Could you talk us through a little bit some of the international reaction? And in Ukraine, Russia, the EU, Britain, what have you been seeing?
Yeah, so Zelensky has obviously condemned what he says is a terrorist act, and he's condemned Russian forces as terrorists. The foreign ministry has used quite similar language, and Zelensky's advisor has said that the world must understand that this is an attempt by terrorists to raise the stakes and scare everyone with a possible nuclear disaster. And now James Cleverly is actually in Ukraine at the moment, and he's visiting Kyiv. And he's denounced this as a war crime and as an abhorrent act. And he wrote on Twitter that intentionally attacking exclusively civilian infrastructure is a war crime. And he's promised more support for Kyiv and for those affected. And in terms of EU reaction, the EU has condemned the destruction of this dam as a new example of the barbaric aggression by Russia against Ukraine. And it calls it a new sign of escalation. And Charles Michel, the president of the European Council, also blamed Russia for the attack.
And Maidna, could you talk us through just very quickly what the Russian reaction to this news has been?
Yeah, so the Kremlin has claimed that this was actually deliberate sabotage by Kyiv, and it's denied that it had anything to do with the attack, and it's decisively rejected accusations by both Ukraine and the West that Moscow forces were behind this blast. And Dmitry Peskov has said, "We can already unequivocally declare that this was deliberate sabotage by the Ukrainian side." And obviously both sides have traded accusations over who is responsible for this.
Thank you very much, Maidna. For everybody listening, Maidna is today running the Ukraine Live blog on the Telegraph website and has just run over from the desk just to give us that international reaction update to the news we've heard this morning. So thank you so much, Maidna, for your time, and best of luck with the rest of the reporting day. And of course, we'd say to all listeners, do go and follow the live blog that Maidna and her colleague Genevieve Hall-Allen run every day of this war. Thank you very much, Maidna, for joining us. I realise it's the only story, really, that we've been talking about today. So, Francis, why don't you talk us through some of your reflections on the news we heard this morning?
Well, thanks, David. I was planning on reflecting on the 79th anniversary of D-Day today and how, of course, it sought to liberate swathes of Europe from imperialist aggression. But given the dam, I'm going to discuss other incidents from World War II instead, particularly the destruction of the Dnieper Dam by the Russians in 1941. I discussed that event on the podcast several months ago when theorizing about the potential impact of what the destruction of this dam would be. But just to familiarize listeners, what happened was that Stalin's secret police blew up the dam in an attempt to slow the advance of Nazi German troops as they swept through Soviet-era Ukraine after Operation Barbarossa. The explosion flooded villages all along the banks of the river. It killed thousands of civilians and military personnel from both sides. After taking over the area, the Germans partially rebuilt the dam, but then 2 years later, as Soviet forces were pushing them out of Ukraine, Nazi troops blew it up for a second time. So Ukraine is sadly no stranger to such incidents, but neither was Europe during that period. Dams were often the targets of Allied bombing raids, for instance, most famously, of course, the Dambusters raid in 1943. Now, the strategic impact of such attacks has often been contested, but what is undeniable is the disruptive impact. By targeting dams, both sides aim to disrupt hydroelectric power generation, water supply, industrial facilities. In the German context, we know it not only affected Germany's ability to produce war materials, but it also hindered transportation and disrupted communication networks. The floods caused considerable casualties and displaced populations, further disrupting normal life in the affected regions, something that, of course, happened also in Ukraine when the Stalin police destroyed the Dnipro Dam. There was also the psychological impact in both instances. I recall, and I've spoken about this on the podcast, that Armaments Minister Albert Speer referenced in his memoirs the huge impact that the destruction of dams and bombing raids had on the German population during the war. And no doubt that was the same in those areas that suffered this. This is, you know, you've got to imagine it, that the area you're listening to this from suddenly overnight is completely flooded and perhaps even permanently so. This is a really major psychological blow to people who are familiar with these areas. And so I think it's just important to emphasize that. And I think that that's, of course, part of it, to try and erode the Ukrainian population's will to resist. But I think, and of course, the strategic calculations, but I think that the main aim here really is to disrupt and stall the possibilities of Ukraine's advances just as they appear on the cusp of being launched, as well as trying to disrupt the narratives, as I say, that have been formulating around this inevitable Ukrainian counteroffensive that will see vast swathes of territory liberated quickly. This will make that almost impossible in these territories, if indeed the counteroffensive was imminent and targeting it there. Clearly, the Russians did think that this was a core target for Ukraine. Now, I think it's important to emphasize that Russia can only do this once, and I'm sure that Ukraine factored in the possibility of the destruction of the dam into their calculations. But nevertheless, this is, I think, a tragic echo, David, on a day when we would normally be commemorating the sacrifice of those who sought to bring about a more peaceful, sovereign Europe. But unfortunately, we've got another echo instead.
Thank you very much, Francis. Roland Oliphant, would you like the very final words?
Yes, today seems to be one of those moments when, you know, I said yesterday, you know, reality will deliver its drama, and it has, you know, in a very forceful manner. Like, that notwithstanding, we can, you know, there's lots of maps about what will be flooded and what will be affected by this. The truth is, we don't know. No one's blown up a dam in Europe for a very, very long time. So, again, I'd caution everybody not to jump to conclusions about how bad this is going to be and what the final outcome is. We don't know, and nobody knows. I think this is another one of those cliches of war. But I think, although we don't know the direct impact on the nuclear power plant or the water supply to Crimea or on, you know, military operations in the upcoming offensive, what is absolutely clear is that from this incident, it's the civilian impact is really, really bad. That is undeniable. And although most of the people who I've got through to today are living on the higher Ukrainian-controlled right bank of the Dnipro, over on the left bank, there are also settlements. It's much lower. It's much more difficult to reach people there. And I fear, you know, even if people have avoided being drowned, the impact on livelihoods, there's footage online of homes literally being swept away. You know, this is going to take years and years to rebuild and get over this level of destruction, whatever else comes out of this.
Last week, I spoke to Volodymyr Kadigrob, founder of the Seeds for Ukraine initiative. After today's story of immense environmental suffering and destruction, his organization's story offers hope for the future by helping Ukrainian families across the country rebuild their lives. Here's our conversation, and for all of our listeners, there's more information on their initiative in the description for this episode. Volodymyr, thank you so much for your time. Could you start just by introducing yourself?
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Volodymyr Kadigrob. I'm from Kyiv, and I'm kind of strategic consultant designer in my normal life, but now mostly volunteer and social entrepreneur. That's how it goes.
So you're involved in this Seeds for Ukraine project. Could you explain what exactly it is and how it started?
So a year ago, a little bit more, last spring, it was the second or third month of the Russian invasion. When the Kyiv region territories were liberated, we saw what happened in Bucha, you know, what happened in Borodyanka, in Kyiv region. And we were shocked and we didn't know how, you know, there were so many people to help. But at the same time, it was the season for the gardens. And in the rural areas, like 99% of Ukrainians have their gardens, they do something. And the logistics were totally broken. And there a lot of people said that they took everything, including the seeds, or just everything was burned or like that. So we decided, of course, it's important to help somehow right now, but also it would be great to empower people and give them something, you know, some tools to grow the food for the communities so they can have, you know, someone will have some work, someone will have something to eat for the year. And it actually goes like fantastic. We didn't expect there was so many support around the world from very different countries. Last year, we managed to help about 10,000 families, which is about 30,000 people around them, maybe more. So it's pretty impressive for a small initiative. And this year we're developing, we receive a lot of requests for help. So we decide to continue.
Could you just describe to us what the process is exactly? So people support, they send money, they buy seeds. What happens then? Where do they go?
So we're wowing. So we're making kind of informational support for that. Yeah, and we were supported also by, for example, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they just tweeted something. For example, last year, Ministry of Foreign Affairs made a tweet. It was retweeted by Le Monde. One brilliant guy from Lille, a farmer, wrote it and decided he gathered. He has about 100 people working. He get 5 people who say we want to help, and they were packing the seeds for this initiative and sending like 10 boxes of the seeds to Poland. Again, logistics is totally broken, right? So it was a humanitarian warehouse in Poland near the border. And then everything was packed there and sent to Kyiv, where volunteers take and pack the seeds into family boxes. So it means 20 packages of different varieties like corn, tomato, cucumber, some greens, legumes, everything, you know. So it's one family seat. So, and then we received from our partners around the regions where that were mostly damaged by war, we received inquiries for like, okay, we have a community for 500 families that need those kind of support. So, and we send it to those people and then send us back reports, photos, and a lot of things from the people. And then something wonderful happens. Like, for example, one community then said that in the end of the season, they managed to make like 4,000 extra cans for tomatoes and cucumbers, like 3 liter. And they send it to the front line. So it was like extra from the seeds that we get. Yeah, it's just one example of how it works.
You mentioned earlier that lots of Ukrainians living in rural areas often have a garden and will grow lots of their own produce.
It's like everybody.
It's something I saw when traveling across the country sort of last year as well. Would you talk a little bit about that? Why is that the case? And what is the relationship between Ukrainians and a love of gardening and growing their own food?
You know, it's historical and cultural thing. It has a positive way because we have strong connection with the land. It's like, it's how it works. And the second, the bad side of all that, it's like we have something on DNA for the last several centuries. We were like, tried to be killed every 10 years. You've just checked the history, you know, the big famine and then mass killings and then mass departures to Siberia. So it's imperial stuff, which we couldn't, in Soviet Union, there was not possible, you know, to reflect, to make history, to make studies about that, right? And we didn't have those capacity during the first 30 years of independence. Just we started to do that. We started to do our homework to understand why we're like that, right? So it's for Ukrainian, there is a lot of jokes. Like in Europe, there are some jokes about British, about Belgium, about French people. Yeah. So about Ukrainians, you can always say that, you know, when you get plenty of land, but you need a little bit more for beetroots. So it's like that. We just need to do some more in case something will happen. And last year, it really happened.
Just looking through some of the examples of what your work has achieved, I got some notes talking about a woman in the Kyiv region who was tortured during the occupation last year, and she was involved in your program, and it helped her regrow lots of her crops. And now this year, she's applied for the project again. Would you talk a little bit more about her? What's her story?
Yeah, it's just one of the like thousands who were under occupation, and she was tortured for nothing. And like her hand were beaten with hammer, but right after this village was liberated, it's just 1 hour from Kyiv. So for your understanding, she said that, okay, we will do our gardens. And I think the project is not just about the food, which is really important, but you know, this kind of sitting, this is very much helpful to mental health, because after you've been lived for like months or 2 months or 3 months under occupation on half year, like in Kherson, for example, and there are regions who are still under occupation, you need somehow to deal with your mental health, right? And I think that this connection to earth, this is something crucial in staying alive and mentally, you know, strong. And those people, they're in rural areas. Everybody are about organic farming. It's a small plots, okay, it's like half hectare. It seems like a small plot in Ukraine, like literally, I mean, half of hectare, it's a small plot. So they're doing this, and I think that helps really staying alive.
There was just another story which would be good to talk about a little bit. In deoccupied Kharkiv, a school in a village where there was also a greenhouse involved as well. So you're not just doing seeds, there's equipment and infrastructure as well.
Yes. We're doing this this year. We started to do greenhouses. Our team member proposed this idea, and this is really goes very well because of huge amount of the minded land. So the agriculture minded land in Ukraine for the moment is like twice size of Austria, to understand that it's just the minded, and it will take a lot of time to manage it, right? So we decide that for communities, we can do some more, and we can provide the greenhouses. And for example, in this village, it's a school. They were also under occupation, and they will do the growing of vegetables, of greens, together with the children or students in the school, right? And also, I think that it's not just for having some vegetables, but also for community, for their like happiness, because you know when you're making community, when you're doing something, this is much more than just grow some food.
Can I ask, obviously, you know, your love of growing things and living things really comes across. Do you have a garden? Do you garden yourself? What do you have in your garden?
Yeah, that's how it started. Exactly, that's how it started. Yes, I'm like 4 years ago, I go into gardening, like a practice, there is also an amazing book by a British writer. She's a psychologist. It's garden therapy, or I don't know how it's in the right translation. Maybe it's, her husband, I know that her husband was a gardener for the Queen Elizabeth.
Wow.
Yes. And I think that's how she got into this. And she wrote this amazing book about how does gardening affects your mental health? How can you regenerate? And you know, in Ukraine, the most problematic thing, except the Russian terrorist state, the second issue is for the moment is mental health, like totally, like everybody. You can just to understand. For the last month, we have 19 air attacks, huge. Like last night, it was 54 drones or something. Yesterday it was 11 ballistic rockets attacking Kyiv. And we are joking that we at least we managed to sleep 8 hours, but it took us 4 days. So it's like there are so many children, there are so many veterans, there so many people who have PTSD and different minor major issues. So I think, like, I don't remember the name of the woman, but the book is amazing. And if she can hear us, I would be happy to invite her to combine the our garden project together with the huge need of mental rehabilitation for the nation.
So what's in your garden at the moment? What are you growing?
Like basic stuff like tomatoes, corn, and some maybe like I have some bamia, if you know, and but batat also, the sweet potato. Yeah, and a lot of flowers. My wife loves flowers, so it's pretty. Yeah, and it is totally rural area. That a lot of birds, no network, and when we can do that, we're blessed that we have this small plot that we can go there and not hear the air alert and the bombs, but we're actually living in Kiev. We work in Kiev, our community, our friends, our parents are in Kiev. So if we can do that once per week, it's amazing, but usually less.
What are your, going back to Seeds for Ukraine, what are your plans this year and in the next few months? What projects are you looking at?
Like for the seeds, we're done for this season. We got quite a lot. We're finishing our delivery to communities. We were in Kherson in Kharkiv region. This is our focus, the occupied territories. And but we have a dream, a target for this season. We want to install 100 greenhouses. It's a small, actually, like, okay, small, 30 square meters greenhouses around the communities in Kharkiv region and in Kherson, to see actually what will happen, what will they do with that. So it definitely gives people like some work, it gives some space to work together, and it gives some, you know, food, because it's a problem. I got from Kherson, and 90% of people working in Agra, they are having, for example, one farmer has 10 hectares, so he can do only a half of a hectare because of the mining. And all his tools, all his techniques, they were damaged or destroyed or stolen. So it's pretty unfair. And those people who just have the most positive work that can be growing something, and it's quite opposite what was done to them. It's just so brutal. It's quite a good idea to help them, help themselves and their communities, not just give them some cans of beans and cans of meat, because there will be a logistic problem. You cannot imagine how it's like look like in those regions. But giving them tools, it's like giving them people hope, and they're very much thankful, very much inspired with this. And we want to see how this experiment will work. And what will they do with those greenhouses, which can work for more than 10 years? If anybody wants to join, there is a website of Seeds of Ukraine. And like, if anybody wants to install in some of the region an own greenhouse named by the person or company, you're very welcome.
We will absolutely add the website to the show notes. So any listeners who are interested, please do go there and check out the website there. Vladimir, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important for our listeners to understand or to know?
I think that it's important to say thanks to all the British people about their brave and very, very strong position about Ukraine. And we feel it very much, because, you know, it's the leadership example of like when somebody are saying values and there are actions about that. So we see that, we feel that, and we want to, it's priceless. That's what I want to say.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us, and best of luck with your harvest this
thank
year.
You thank you, good luck.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk
patreon.com/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload, so if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to podcast apps. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. Ukraine the Latest is produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are Louisa Wells and David Knowles.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.